Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up on today's programme, the British government has refused to let people from the Chagos Islands return to the land from which they were kicked off 50 years ago. We hear from the president of the provisional government of the Diego Garcia and the Chagos Islands this hour.
Two alleged FARC guerrilla fighters were killed by Colombian authorities, according to reports emerging this week. But amidst an already fragile ceasefire, incidents like this illustrate the dangers of moving slowly on the FARC peace deal.
Sunni tribal chiefs in Iraq have joined a chorus of condemnation started by Amnesty International last week that Shiite militias have been murdering Sunni civilians in areas liberated from Daesh in Iraq. We ask how this will impact upon the Iraq's unity while it battles to release Mosul from Daesh's grip.
Transparency organisations have joined with European lawmakers in a campaign to bring about a law protecting whistleblowers. The campaign focuses on the tax avoidance scandals that have rocked Europe over the past months and raises the question of when it's acceptable for EU citizens to question their employees' wrongdoings.
Libyan pro-government forces are closing in on what remains of Daesh's stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte. We hear how Sirte's fall might affect the jihadist group's future ambitions and defence tactics.
And firefighters in Denmark had a rather odd emergency situation this week when a young man got stuck in his own desk.
All that and more over the next hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
The British Foreign Office has announced that Chagos Islanders will not be allowed to return to their Indian Ocean homes. The island's inhabitants were expelled in the 1960s to make way for military bases, but will not be allowed to return, with the government citing the UK's interest in its, quote, defence relationship with the United States.
Instead, it has been decided that the Chagosians will be offered compensation worth £40 million over the next 10 years. Confirmation of the ban on resettlement follows decades of unsuccessful legal challenges in the UK against removal by members of the Chagossian community who've been resettled in Britain. Liam O'Hare has more.
This is a struggle and a story that goes back many decades. The inhabitants of the Chagos Islands were forced to leave by the British government between 1967 and 1973, when the land was leased to the US to build an air base at Diego Garcia. But critics have called that act a black mark on the British Empire, and a United Nations tribunal has ruled that Britain acted illegally in the way that it exercised territorial control over the Chagos Islands. In its announcement yesterday, the UK government also confirmed that it will allow the United States to keep its military base in the islands in the British Indian Ocean Territory. Well, earlier I was joined by Alan Venkatesan, President of the Provisional Government of Diego Garcia and the Chagos Islands. I asked him for his response to yesterday's verdict.
I am very disappointed that the government has not allowed a resettlement, a pilot resettlement on the islands, whilst the firm KPMG has said that there is no barrier to resettlement.
And this has obviously been a very long struggle for many decades. Is this now the end of the road for resettlement, do you think?
We will have to continue to press the government for a return, because this is our homeland. We've been evicted from it. Now we've spent about 50 years in exile, and some of us are living in the UK. Our life has been wrecked. Our destiny has been wrecked. But we will continue to pursue, our right of return.
And just, you were actually born in the Chagos Islands, is that correct?
Yes, I was born on Diego Garcia. Yes, I was 1 year old when my family and I, we were evicted from our homeland.
And just briefly, could you give us a context of what that eviction was like, how that took place?
We were told that we had to leave our homeland and that the Americans was going to build a base there. And we were just shipped to Mauritius and dumped on the wharf without any housing, job, provisions at all. We had to fend for ourselves in a new country.
There was no dialogue, there was no decision given to you about that at all?
No. We were just surprised when we arrived in Mauritius that, we then saw our fate was already concluded, by the decision makers, that we had nothing.
The British government has said it's expected to issue an apology, and it said that it will offer compensation to the inhabitants of the Chagos. Is that something that you welcome?
We welcome the package of £40 million, which will go towards supporting our community here in the UK, in Mauritius, in the Seychelles and elsewhere. But that has nothing to do with our right of return. This is a package to support the community because there are situations, a community which need to be resolved. There are, you know, people need support and training and able to find their life, a good life, and increase their income, you know, for their families.
And there are allegations that on Diego Garcia just now, where the US military base is, that it's been used for purposes such as torture. How does that make yourself, as obviously an inhabitant and somebody indigenous to the islands, feel about the purposes of what the islands are now being used for?
I believe the UK is definitely against torture, and if torture has been done on Diego Garcia, I think it's a very bad thing, and this should not happen again. And I don't think, you know, it's good to bring other people in our homeland and so that they get tortured. So that is quite a serious issue.
And just lastly there, Alan, you have been involved in this for a number of years. What is your next step in this struggle?
I will be making decisions in our cabinet, the cabinet of our provisional government, very soon to see how we want to proceed and move forward and see what's best for the people and consult with the people and see what needs to be done.
Alan Venkatesan, the President of the Provisional Government of Diego Garcia and the Chagos Islands, thanks so much for joining us today on World in Focus.
Thank you, my pleasure.
In the last 24 hours, reports have emerged that two alleged FARC guerrilla rebel fighters were killed by security forces in northern Bolivar province of Colombia. According to the Ministry of Defence, the guerrillas were some distance from the pre-demobilisation zone, as defined by the ongoing ceasefire agreed with the government, and were involved in an operation of, quote, criminal character.
The deaths occur at a fragile time for Colombia's peace process, with a newly agreed deal with the FARC rebels reached only 4 days ago, in the wake of the previous deal's shock defeat in October's referendum. The revised deal struck this week in Havana is understood to be the last version, to be considered, regardless of opposition to some of its content. Chief government negotiator Humberto de la Calle said earlier this week that, quote, this is the final accord, it's the definitive accord, there's really no room for more negotiation.
The reported deaths of the two alleged FARC rebel fighters this week is illustrative of the need to speed up the peace process. Should the peace accord be successfully implemented, it will draw to a close a 52-year war which has devastated Colombia and seen over a quarter of a million dead and millions more displaced. Currently, the ceasefire continues and both sides are keen to make a peace deal work. Its approval, though, will most likely lie in the hands of Congress, with a second plebiscite looking extremely unlikely.
With me on the line now from London is Hassan Dodwell from Justice for Colombia. Thanks for speaking with us today, Hassan. How concerned should we be by these deaths and just how do they sit with the ceasefire?
Well, I certainly would hope not, and I think that might be a bit too dramatic. There's certainly a concern. I mean, there's always a danger, and both the government and the FARC have constantly mentioned that there is a ceasefire, but it's fragile, and the longer it goes on, obviously the more risk there is of incidents like this taking place. But in terms of this incident, there's still a verification process to take place to find out exactly what has happened. At the moment, it's a lot of conjecture from the press. So I think we should sort of not jump to conclusions. There's still undoubtedly commitment from the government and the FARC to this peace process. And we're certainly sort of waiting to see what the verification process brings out.
Well, if we were to take what you're saying as being correct, that we shouldn't jump to conclusions, we don't know exactly what's going on, but we look at just the reaction to this and the situation itself, does that illustrate a risk of moving slowly with the peace process?
Definitely. I mean, we have to go at the pace that the context allows. I mean, you can't rush things, but what's clear is that both the FARC negotiators and the government negotiators are now ready to begin the implementation phase. They want to get this new deal ratified as soon as possible, whether that is through Congress, as is being suggested that will happen. And the sooner the ratification can take place, then the international oversight of the demobilisation process and the ongoing ceasefire can take place. And that can only be a good thing for those communities and populations that have been facing the brunt of the civil war, but also importantly to ensure the protection of the FARC guerrillas who are going to be demobilizing. Because obviously we've seen in the past how the attacks and killings of demobilized guerrillas in the 1980s can really damage a peace process. So definitely, hopefully we can get the verification process, the oversight up and running as soon as possible to avoid these types of potential dangers.
There have been some suggestions, and obviously it's speculation, it's conjecture, but the longer this process drags out, the more likely that some members of the FARC disaffected by the peace process and the demobilization might be more inclined to desert for either for other organizations or to form new ones. Is that a valid concern, or is that maybe overplaying that risk?
Well, certainly from our experience, and Justice for Colombia has been working very closely with the peace process, with the FARC negotiators and the government negotiators. And these kind of statements and ideas, I think, are largely conjecture and largely form part of the anti-peace propaganda that is often sort of promoted, which tries to suggest that the guerrillas are disunited, that they're not a political organization with a political vision, that you know they're likely to crumble and their fighters to join other groups. That's certainly not what we've been hearing. It's certainly not what has been playing out over the last few years during the peace process. And if we listen to these kind of predictions were happening before the peace process began, at the beginning of the peace process, and it hasn't become a reality. So we certainly see no reason for those kind of things to happen in terms of the FARC fighters. There seems to be a commitment to the peace process. But that's not to say, as I said previously, that the sooner the peace process can be fully ratified and the D-Day to begin, which ignites all the process of demobilization and concentration of FARC troops, the sooner that can happen and the sooner the implementation of the agreement can begin to take place, well, the better for Colombian people and particularly for those people that have been most hit by the armed conflict.
And you're talking about ratifying that peace deal. Now, obviously, the initial peace deal was rejected controversially, very, very narrowly rejected in the referendum last month. And just this week, we have a new agreement, which looks like it probably won't go to a referendum. It will probably be decided by Congress. What are the major differences between the new agreement and the one that was rejected last month?
Sure. I mean, importantly, like you say, that there was a referendum and the peace deal, as it was rejected narrowly. So it's really important for both the negotiators, the FARC and the government, to recognise that, because having a peace agreement with this big division would be difficult going forward in the implementation stage, which is obviously going to go on for many years. So I think the first thing that they wanted to do is to listen to those concerns that many had, and they did that. The FARC and the government had many meetings. Also important to mention, this was happening at the same time as there was big mobilizations across Colombia in support of the peace process in rejection of the referendum result. So the key changes have sort of responded to some of those concerns to bring in as many people as possible into this final peace agreements that maybe felt a little bit like they weren't included previously. But fundamentally, the core elements to the peace agreement as it was before and as it is now, that is that this is a negotiation between the FARC and the government in which the FARC are going to leave their armed struggle behind to take part in the political process. That continues. The justice, there's been a lot of changes to how the justice special jurisdiction justice system will work, but fundamentally again it will be the same process. If those that have committed crimes in the armed conflict give the full truth about what has happened and fully participate in that truth process, they will have reduced sentences and be able to take part in the political system if they wish to do so. So the core elements remain the same, but there are lots of changes throughout the document that just clarify things and just make sure that those voices that previously were feeling that they were left out now feel much more included. So now really there's a lot of hope that this agreement will now be fully implemented and we can move on to the next stage.
And how are the opponents of the peace deal, how receptive are they to this new deal? Because obviously last time round it was this referendum, you know, the people of Colombia will decide. Then obviously it was rejected at the ballot box. And then President Santos was saying that, well, this is a great opportunity for our conversation. We must get this right. We must get this nailed. And now the option that's on the table seems to be, this is non-negotiable, this is what's going forward, there won't be another referendum. How is that sitting with opponents?
The no camp have different representatives. There's many different voices there. Some of them have spoken out already over the last couple of days that they're not happy that it is no longer negotiable, which is according to what the negotiators have so far said. So there seems to be a bit of disquiet about that. The one thing we have to remember is that there are political interests here. There's a presidential election coming in 2018. And whilst there was, without doubt, were those that supported no who had legitimate concerns, and like I say, many of those were hopefully responded to. You know, we need to hear from all those people in groups, and they haven't all spoken out and responded yet. But there are some that have responded. We have to remember that there are political interests. Rejecting the peace process is a political position, and it's very possible that whatever the peace agreement is and whatever is in it, it will be rejected by some people. So that is almost inevitable, unfortunately. But that's not to say that the agreement hasn't responded to the concerns of those that voted and campaigned for no.
Well, Hassan Dodwell, thank you very much for talking to us.
That's a pleasure.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, Sunni tribal chiefs in Iraq have joined a chorus of condemnation started by Amnesty International last week that Shiite militias have been murdering Sunni civilians in areas liberated from Daesh in Iraq. We ask how this will impact upon the Iraq's unity while it battles to release Mosul from Daesh's grip.
Could the e-krona bring a digital currency revolution? Sweden's national bank Riksbank has announced plans to launch the world's first national digital currency. The bank has a history of setting trends in monetary use, being the first bank to issue paper notes in the 17th century, so could digital currencies soon become the banking norm?
Will Scotland follow the Norway model by staying in the EU single market? The country's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, confirmed that she is exploring joining the European Free Trade Association following Britain's vote to leave the European Union.
And firefighters in Denmark had a rather strange emergency situation this week when a young man got stuck in his own desk.
Fair enough.
A Sunni Arab tribal leader has accused Shiite militias of killing civilians in towns and villages to the south of Mosul that have been freed from the control of Daesh. The attacks have raised concerns about how Iraq can recover even after an eventual Daesh defeat from the spectre of sectarianism. Matthew Eaton has more.
Arab tribal chiefs have accused Shiite militias of shelling civilians west of Mosul, in addition to carrying out extrajudicial killings in villages near the town of Tal Afar. The accusation comes on the heels of a report last week by Amnesty International that said Shiite militias had been targeting Sunni Muslims south of Mosul. Mosul, Iraq's second city, stands as Daesh's last major stronghold in Iraq, which is slowly being encircled by Iraqi forces with backing from Kurdish Peshmerga and largely government-sponsored Shiite militiamen. Iraqi Sheikh Jama Ahmed Dawa has accused fighters from the Hashad al-Shabi militia of extrajudicial killings in villages taken from Daesh jihadists. Well, joining me on the line to discuss this now is Talha Abdulrazak, an Iraq specialist and researcher at the University of Exeter's Strategy and Security Institute. Talha, firstly, thank you for joining us. This isn't the first time that Shiite militias have been accused of sectarian reprisals against Sunni civilians, is it? Can you tell us a bit about the origins of that, the historical background of the Sunni-Shia sectarianism in Iraq?
Well, I mean, I think the origins of it are, you know, frankly speaking, back all the way, go all the way back to the Iran-Iraq war. If you look at militia commanders like Hadi al-Amri, for example, who's the commander of the Badr organization, who also held cabinet positions in the Iraqi government, this is a man of extreme power and has incredible reach and is directly linked to Iran. Now, he fought with the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war, so he actually fought his own country during that war, and now he's the commander of one of the biggest and most powerful militias in the country. Now, after Saddam Hussein was toppled, you had the introduction of, dozens. In fact, it's probably reached around close to 100 now, of Iraqi Shia militias directly funded, backed, supported, trained, and ideologically aligned to Iran. So that is kind of the real origin there. And obviously there, the Iranian regime has an interest in pushing these groups because they have an ideological objective of controlling this entire area, especially as the shrines of Najaf, Karbala, and the other Shia areas are host to them, fall within Iraq, which was traditionally ruled by Sunnis for a millennia and a half almost.
That ties in nicely with what I wanted to ask you next. Reports say that these militias are, as you said, armed and trained by the Islamic Republic of Iran, which some say means that the government, that is the Iranian government, has culpability for these attacks on Sunni civilians. Is that a statement you would agree with?
Well, yeah. I mean, if we look at the international humanitarian law and the laws of war, these groups operate under the direction of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, specifically Qasem Soleimani, who's the commander of the Quds Force. Now, not too long ago, also, they announced the formation of a Shia Liberation Army. They later pared it down and they called it just the Liberation Army. Then they, they struck up the whole Shia thing. But the fact that they actually announced this and they declared that foreign fighters who are loyal to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, they dropped the Shia identifier on the Liberation Army bit, but it's still the same thing. So they openly admitted to foreign fighters who are Afghans, who are Iraqis, some Syrian Alawites, Lebanese faction like Hezbollah, fighting under their banner, under the IRGC's banner, in Yemen, in Iraq, and in Syria. So they are directly linking these groups to themselves. And it's not only the Iranian government that has culpability for these war crimes. It's actually the Iraqi authorities themselves in Baghdad, because Baghdad, several months ago, formalized the popular mobilization forces, which are largely Shia-dominated, as well as Iranian-backed. They formalized them as a formal wing of the Iraqi security services. So they're separate to the Iraqi army, a paramilitary force, modeled on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iraq.
At a time when Iraq needs to be unifying against a common enemy, Daesh, such sectarianized attacks aren't really going to help much in the fight, or I'd imagine in attempts to reconstruct the country and unify it after Daesh has been defeated. So why do these Shiite militias continue to carry out these attacks?
Well, there's a simple reason that they see everything in black and white terms. So they see Sunni civilians part of a 1,400-year plot against the Shia imams, and this is kind of the phrasing that's used. Obviously, the people right at the top in Iran are a bit more pragmatic, but they do play on these sentiments in order to encourage people to fight and to kill in their name. So, Daesh, I don't believe that it will be defeated directly, because there is no political component to this military strategy. They're coming into Mosul and the area around Mosul. They've committed atrocities, not just in Mosul, in Anbar, Fallujah, Ramadi, and Salah ad-Din, for example, in Tikrit, in Jufa Sakhar, these other areas. So the Sunni community, who, by the way, they are the ones who defeated Al-Qaeda in 2008, they have no reason to take up arms against ISIS, even if they don't like them. Even if they don't like Daesh, they have no reason to fight against Daesh, because the last time they fought against Al-Qaeda, which is, Daesh's father, parent organization, you could say, immediately afterwards, the Maliki government, directly backed by Iran again, began to discriminate against them, began arresting Sunnis, began torturing them, or I should say resumed torturing them, resumed killing them. So they have no incentive. Why should the Sunni Arab community fight only to be killed further on down the line by their own government?
And just finally, could the Iraqi government actually rein in these militias, and does it even have an interest in doing so?
Not at all. The militias who are fighting under the Popular Mobilization Forces banner already an official part of the Iraqi security structure. So they are technically answerable to the commander-in-chief, who is Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. And yet he's done nothing, he said nothing. In fact, not too long ago, the Speaker of Parliament, Salim al-Jabouri, himself a Sunni, denied that any atrocities were taking place in and around the vicinity of Mosul. This is rather shocking to some people who don't really know much about Iraqi affairs. But Salim al-Jabouri and a few others around him are essentially token Sunnis who have no credibility amongst the Sunni Arab community. So when you have people like this, whitewashing militia crimes, there are a number of interest groups in Iraq. Different politicians hold different ministries who in turn earn a lot of money through various corruption scandals, and they expose each other all the time. I mean, we just saw a couple of months ago they got rid of Hoshyar al-Zubairi, who was the former foreign minister and former finance minister. They also got rid of Khaled al-Abadi, who was the defense minister. All of it was on corruption charges, and all of it was raised by the Maliki bloc in parliament, again, Shi'i parliament, parliamentary bloc. So they have no interest, really, in stamping out the sectarianism. They think that they can actually stop it by killing as many Sunnis as possible and cowing them, because they associate all Sunnis with Daesh.
Okay, Talha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for calling.
Could the e-krona lead a currency revolution? Sweden's central bank, Riksbank, has announced plans to develop a national digital currency. The e-krona would be the first national e-currency in the world, and Deputy Governor of Riksbank, Cecilia Skingsley, believes that it could be as revolutionary as the launch of paper banknotes.
What technology will be used and how the currency will be regulated is yet to be confirmed, but Riksbank has a history in monetary innovation. In the 1660s, Riksbank was the first bank in the world to issue paper banknotes, which, of course, became the global norm. And now that the use of hard cash has seen a notable decline through technological advancements, a digital currency could just be the currency of the future.
Joining me on the line to discuss this further is Dr. Catherine Mulligan from Imperial College London's Centre for Cryptocurrency Research and Engineering. Dr. Mulligan, digital transactions are now commonplace. I personally pay for most things using my phone and I transfer money online. So how does a digital currency differ from simply using a currency digitally?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the difference from an end user's perspective, you won't notice it at all. What is actually happening is the difference is, you know, with the, well, the difference has got to do with the mechanisms by which money is moved. So conventionally, digital money movements, so when you're paying with your phone, they depend heavily on trusted intermediaries, banks usually in this case, and it effectively involves updates to account balances and databases which are under control of those parties. And that's actually quite expensive and can involve delays and all these kind of things. So more importantly, you also have to trust that the banks involved act honestly and update the relevant databases sort of correctly. But cryptocurrency or digital currencies, on the other hand, remove the need for those sort of trusted intermediaries, and it enables the direct exchange of value between two parties in a way that's tamper-proof and prevents what we call double spending. So it's much cheaper to do it that way. But from a central banking application perspective, you know, they probably want to regain or retain some type of control over the exchange of money in that sense.
And it seems to change the entire philosophy of what we view as money. I mean, traditionally, a piece of gold or an exchange of goods. Now we're talking about a thing that we can't actually see, we can't hold, we can't take in our hands. You know, how is that going to massively change the way that we view monetary value as well, do you think?
Yeah, and I think, so the announcement by the Swedish Central Bank, actually, that they're looking at using an e-currency or an e-krona, as they call it, is actually really quite pertinent to that question. So, yes, it means that we are moving towards a type of monetary system where we can't actually hold on to cash, even if it's a piece of paper or a piece of gold. So you're completely correct. And we have to, you know, it means that basically the manner in which we exchange value changes. So it raises some really interesting questions around what is money and how does that function within our society. But, you know, the other side of that is actually a lot of our transactions are pretty much cashless in today's society. So we are already using digital technologies quite extensively within the monetary system. The difference is that cryptocurrencies or, you know, fiat-backed cryptocurrencies basically change or challenge some of our ideas around macroeconomics and potentially monetary policy even for the country.
Mm-hmm. And is there not an element of risk with regards to computer breakdowns and cyber attacks and hacking? You know, these is all kind of the idea that all money is kept electronically sounds a little bit risky.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, if you think about this in a broader perspective, so we've seen a lot of hacks recently. So we've seen the recent hack on the Tesco Bank. And actually, the reason that they were able to hack that is because of the centralized database that I mentioned previously. You know, a cryptocurrency is actually slightly more secure than that. But of course, all digital technologies are vulnerable to hacking or fraud, like anything is. And actually, you know, cash itself is also heavily subject to fraud and also theft. So the one good thing about digital currencies is that if you are subject to fraud, it's much easier to roll back the transaction. So you could get your money back much easier.
Mm-hmm. And you said earlier, you know, there won't be that much difference to the end user. I can probably still continue to buy my lunch using my Apple Pay on my phone. But what potential impact could this have on markets and the economy?
It's actually a very, very interesting question because it's actually quite open. That's why there's a number of central banks across the world who actually have this as a research agenda. So, for example, it challenges monetary policy. So if you have a digitally or a fiat-backed cryptocurrency, say you have a cryptocurrency that is a pound sterling, it challenges, you know, do we have an inflationary economy? Do we have a deflationary economy? I mean, these are very profound questions for the monetary system.
Could this at some point turn into a global currency, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at Bitcoin, Bitcoin really is a global currency already. The issues that, you know, I think there are some other foundational issues that need to be understood as well. So, for example, if you move to a digitally enabled pound, for example, what happens to the commercial banking system? Because if you have, you know, if everyone has a bank account with the central bank, there's a big problem there for the commercial banking system. So, you know, you can effectively cause the collapse of the commercial banking system. And obviously, central banks don't want to see that happen. Everyone wants to keep a fully functioning commercial banking system. So that's one of the research questions.
Well, I imagine it's an incredibly interesting time for people like yourselves looking into all of this as these things kind of evolve.
Yes, absolutely. It's hugely exciting. Great questions come up from this.
Yeah, well, Catherine, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, has confirmed that she is considering a Norway-style model for keeping Scotland in the EU single market. Scotland's First Minister said that the European Free Trade Association, EFTA, and European Economic Area, EEA, models were being looked at.
The EEA includes the existing EU states in addition to EFTA members Iceland, Liechtenstein and Norway. However, in order for the plan to go ahead, Scotland would have to rely on the agreement of the EEA members and the United Kingdom. Liam O'Hare has more.
The context of this, of course, is that the majority of people in Scotland voted to stay in the European Union, but face being dragged out against their will. Now, membership of the European Economic Area offers access to that all-important single market. However, members must make a financial contribution and adopt most EU legislation as well as the free movement of people. And there have been warnings that Scotland would struggle to join EFTA as it is not strictly a sovereign nation. Well, earlier I was joined by the co-founder of the Radical Independence Campaign, Jonathan Chaffee, and I asked him how likely he thinks the proposal is.
Well, Nicola Sturgeon's put this out as a possibility and the possibility of a compromise, but actually it looks quite difficult because if you start to open yourself up to the programme that Norway, for example, subscribes to where you're a member of the common market, it also includes the feature that you would have to have as part of that, which is freedom of movement. That raises all sorts of questions, not least the constitutional question, when it comes to Scotland's relationship with England and the rest of the UK. Can you be a member of the common market, have freedom of movement and share a border with the rest of the UK? I think that would be unlikely.
And obviously Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP are looking at a variety of options to maintain Scotland's membership of the single market. But is this all really just a game that's been played out, and in actual fact, what they want and what they know is going to happen is a second referendum on independence?
Well, a second referendum on independence, I think, is actually seen as more important in many ways than being a member of the single market. Remember, of course, that the single market, all it really means is that you are part of a free trade bloc. There are still many ways that you can trade, many different angles that you can take as a country, as an economy, for growth, for building relationships with other people in the world. I think it's just that it's been done so badly and done in such a toxic manner by the Brexiteers, by the hard right of the Tory party and indeed the May government as a whole, that it's repulsive to not just people in Scotland, but I would argue a growing number of people across the UK. But this is all, of course, underpinned by that big question, a second referendum, Scotland being independent and being independent within the EU. And that's what Sturgeon wants. And I think that's the sort of strategy that we'll see come to play over the next year or so.
We had a High Court ruling not too long ago that said that Brexit must be sanctioned by the Westminster Parliament. Article 50, the process for leaving the European Union, must be sanctioned by Westminster. Could this potentially put the blocks on Brexit altogether?
Well, you've seen today Alex Salmond has talked about there being red lines that should they be crossed, they would leave a variety of options open in terms of what the SNP is going to vote when it comes to Brexit. But right now the position is that they'll be voting against it. Labour, and led by Jeremy Corbyn, of course, they're taking a different position. They're saying they're going to support Brexit on the basis that it is a people's Brexit, one that works for ordinary people right across the UK. I think they feel compelled to do that because not doing that would leave the door wide open for the likes of UKIP to take the ground when it comes to the question of Brexit and the outcome of the EU referendum. I think we've got a long way to go when it comes to the UK leaving the EU. It's going to be messy. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be difficult, I think, not just for the politicians, but also for the business people and the business community and the City of London and all of the associated institutions. It's going to be a very difficult, complex, and I think messy process.
We're obviously seeing a wave of anti-establishment feeling across not just Europe, but we've seen it in America recently with the election of Donald Trump as well. How has Scotland been insulated in some way by that? Because it seems, despite a lot of the same social conditions existing in Scotland, you don't quite have the same anti-immigrant feeling or perhaps even anti-EU feeling that you get elsewhere.
There's no doubt that there is an increase in anti-immigrant feeling, but there is a reason for this, and there is an important, I think, element which is often missed out of the debate, and that is essentially the following, that the parties that should and used to represent working people right across Europe, Western Europe and in America have triangulated to the right for so long at the same time as there being a collapse of living standards. So, for example, if you look at the US election, it wasn't so much that Trump won the vote, it was more that the Democratic vote collapsed by around 6.5 million votes. This is being underpinned and is being associated with anti-immigration, and it's being used in such a way by forces on the right as a lightning rod for wider concerns. But if you look at the research and you drill into the studies of people who are voting for Brexit or voting for Trump, you find that concerns about immigration are often, if not always, closely tied to class concerns around living standards, cuts to social services, a sense of there being economic injustice and inequality. And it seems to me that that is what really underpins what we're seeing take place across Europe and in America.
And just lastly, Jonathan, if you had to put your mortgage, put a bet on when you reckon the next referendum on Scottish independence would be, where would you put it?
At this point, I think that it's going to take some time for the negotiations around the EU to take place. I think they'll want to have it, though, before the UK is formally out of the European Union, but also at a time where negotiations will be going on. So I think it's got a long way to go yet. In some ways, I don't think it's going to be next year or even the year after. I think in the next 3 or 4 years, we'll see something come forward.
Jonathan Chaffee, co-founder of the Radical Independence Campaign, thanks for joining us today on World in Focus.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, transparency organisations have joined with European lawmakers in a campaign to bring about a law protecting whistleblowers. The campaign focuses on the tax avoidance scandals that have rocked Europe over the past months and raises the question of when it's acceptable for EU citizens to question their employees' wrongdoings.
Libyan pro-government forces are closing in on what remains of Daesh's stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte. We hear how Sirte's fall might affect the jihadist group's future ambitions and defence tactics.
And, well, it's happened to all of us at some point in our lives. Firefighters in Denmark had a rather odd emergency situation this week when a young man got stuck in his own desk.
Never happened to me.
61 organisations have joined EU lawmakers in a campaign to force the EU to bring in a law protecting whistleblowers. The campaign was spearheaded by supporters of LuxLeaks sources Antoine Deltour and Raphael Hallet, who were found guilty of theft in exposing corporate tax avoidance. The issue goes to the heart of the tax avoidance scandals that have rocked Europe in the past few months and brings into question the right of EU citizens to blow the whistle on their employers' wrongdoings.
Sputnik's Jim Ensom has been following the case and joins me on the line. Jim, what is the latest on these calls for a whistleblower's law?
Well, a group of transparency campaigners, including Transparency International, mainly from their Brussels office, are calling for there to be a law passed by Brussels protecting whistleblowers who let information get out about the wrongdoing of their employers if it's a matter of major public interest. Now, this really does go back to the LuxLeaks. If you remember, Antoine Deltour and Raphael Allais were employees of an accountancy firm who were found guilty of stealing documents, revealing business secrets, and they were accused of violating trade secrets and theft. This was the whole package of stuff that revealed the LuxLeaks, a list of more than 300 firms that were using legal measures to put their assets and various trade logs via Luxembourg in order to enjoy beneficial tax regime. Now, they were in fact found guilty, although their suspended sentences were given to them, etc. But nonetheless, everyone said this is a very, very vital piece and we need to protect whistleblowers like this in the future.
And that's become quite a campaign then, has it? The campaign to try and legislate to protect these whistleblowers?
Yes, exactly, because a lot of people said what we need is we need an actual law in place that says whistleblowers must be protected. Now, the EU was trying to put through a piece of legislation last year about the protection of trademarks. Now, this is really interesting, Caroline, because what they were saying was nobody is allowed to give away any information about something which is a trademark or something was a trade secret. And a lot of the campaigners were saying, well, hang on a minute. This could be used to gag whistleblowers, legitimately trying to give away details of a company's misdeeds, but the company could be using the trademarks directive to counter that. And that's one of the major issues. So hence the reason why these 61 organizations, all privacy and human rights groups right the way throughout Europe, are now saying, hang on, this is not good enough. We're not doing enough to protect our whistleblowers.
And I imagine it's a complex area to try and legislate over, because surely the matter of what counts as being of a matter of major public interest is inherently quite subjective.
You're absolutely right. What's interesting to the public is not necessarily of public interest. And to what extent are you supposed to be an employee of a company? Because a lot of people have got it written in the contracts, you know, you shall not divulge any of the public secrets. And of course, so much of what is being done nowadays is done on computers, etc. It's done on algorithms and all these sort of things. And in particular, the whistleblowers over Panama leaks and the Lux leaks and the Bermuda Papers and all of those are all to do with really, really nuanced areas of tax avoidance, which borders on being illegal, but it may be unethical. And the big problem, as you quite rightly point out, is at what point does public interest mean exposing something that's unethical but not illegal? And that's the real problem that having to counter with.
And just finally, Jim, I know that you focus on the European Parliament regularly. You're always looking at the goings-on of the EU. What do you think might happen within the EU regarding this law?
I think they're going to go through the same process as they did with the directive on trade secrets. I think that you will get the usual lot from the Social Democrats through to the Greens, etc. They will obviously lobby to say, come on, we really need protection for whistleblowers. And then you will get likely the right-wingers, the EPP group, for instance, etc., supported perhaps by the Liberal Democrats, saying, well, hang on a minute, we need nuances in this. And it'll all go down to the small print. And as usual, all end up in a wonderful Brussels fudge.
Well, Jim Ensom, thank you very much.
In an attempt to push back the advancing force of pro-government forces, Daesh's battlefield tactics have become even more brutal in a desperate attempt to cling on to its last major base in Libya. The offensive on Sirte continues while the battle for Mosul rages in Iraq's second city, Mosul. Matthew Ayton has more on how Sirte's fall might impact upon the fight for Mosul.
Libyan pro-government forces are close to ousting Daesh from its stronghold in the coastal city of Sirte, but face a network of booby traps, improvised explosives and snipers. After nearly 6 months of fighting to extirpate the jihadist group from Sirte, pro-government forces have managed to box them within an area less than 1 square mile. While Sirte is on the verge of falling into pro-government hands, the brutal tactics deployed by the group to hang on to Sirte may be an ominous sign of how they might try to defend other areas under their control. Already there have been reports that the group has deployed child suicide bombers in a desperate attempt to repel advancing forces in Mosul, Iraq. Sirte easily fell into the hands of Daesh as internecine fighting swept Libya following the ouster of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. The UN-backed government in Tripoli is working to unite Libya's competing factions and their respective armed wings in order to deliver the death knell to Daesh. So far, more than 500 of the pro-government fighters have been killed, some by Daesh snipers, but most by machine gun fire. Joining me to discuss Daesh's future in Libya and beyond is Jason Pack, founder of EyeOnISISInLibya.com. Jason, thanks for talking to us. So first of all, do you see any similarity between the tactics Daesh is using in Iraq to defend Mosul and those it is using in Libya to defend Sirte?
Well, certainly. One, we've seen that Daesh has a habit of counterattacking behind enemy lines. So the very simplest is that even before the assault on Mosul began, as Daesh was losing territory, be it in Manbij or elsewhere, they do bombs in Baghdad, way behind enemy lines. It's true in Libya there have not been major attacks in, say, Tripoli or Misrata because ISIS seems to lack that capacity. Even as they're pinned into an area in Sirte, they then have an attack outside of that area on Misratan forces. So it's been surprising to those who don't watch closely that ISIS might be pinned in an area that's only 1 square mile in the center of Sirte, but yet they're able to attack checkpoints far outside that area. And I would say that that's the primary kind of Daesh defense tactic. The other is the use of, you know, sand barriers and broken bits of buildings and booby traps. And clearly these guys have all studied together because they trained together in Iraq. Do you know what I mean? The fighters, the top fighters, for the most part, were all together in Iraq. It doesn't matter if they were Tunisian in nationality or Libyan or Syrian. Yes, there is something as essentially a Daesh operational manual, and they hem to it directly.
Do you think that there are any lessons that the Syrian opposition groups, perhaps the Kurdish YPG and the Iraqi military, could learn from Libya's Sirte experience in order to push Daesh out of Raqqa and Mosul?
So I think there are many. As I mentioned, I've written about this with my partner, Rhiannon Smith, in Hate Speech International. And the primary one for me is that you need to have the phasing of the operation correct. And of course, we haven't done that. So both of these operations started with massive propaganda campaigns. We are going to be launching the Sirte offensive, or we are going to be launching the Mosul offensive. And then the offensive didn't start with either an aerial bombardment or a siege. It should have actually been a surprise siege so that you don't let the key Daesh assets escape. And of course, by having propaganda before a siege, all the key assets escaped. We didn't even have a naval blockade of Sirte. And this allowed, you know, supplies to come in, top fighters to go out. Fascinatingly, it appears to not be an error, but to be a coalition strategy, because people know that either the Misratan Bunyan Marsous in the Sirte offensive, or whether it's the YPG or the Peshmerga or the Iraqi counterterrorism force, they're not going to want to fight pitched battles against the top Daesh people. So they're like, well, the top people can leave and flee. We just want to conquer the territory, you know, fighting against weaker opposition. And this is a kind of kick the can down the road, try to get a propaganda success by retaking territory. And it kind of worked in both cases, in the sense that in the early days of June in Libya, when the offensive against Sirte began, territory was conquered quite easily.
Sure. And just finally, how close to reconciliation are the UN-backed government in Tripoli and Field Marshal Haftar's government? I mean, after all, is this not the key to unlocking unity in Libya, which is important to defeating ISIS?
It is the key. I can't say that they're much closer. The government of national accord has been unraveling over the past weeks and months. The Trump factor does seem to be strengthening Haftar. Since Haftar took over the oil crescent on September 11th of this year, the need to include him has been greater and greater, and people are discussing ways to do that. So there's some potentiality there, but it might be that the general national accord structure is itself so flawed that a new negotiation, either through the UN or potentially not through the UN, to build up a new list of names and a slightly new process is needed to include the real stakeholders, both Haftar and other military and militia stakeholders. And I've long been an advocate for having the real stakeholders in the room, not just elected politicians who have no power and answer to the militias, but actually getting the militia commanders and local council leaders in the room. Hey, guys, this is your country. We want you to govern it, but you just need to have some kind of power-sharing agreement, and then we can help you if you all work together. People are afraid that that will legitimize those who have taken power by force, but they have power, and we need to deal with them. And that's becoming to be understood as people are pivoting towards dealing with Haftar.
Okay, Jason Pack, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
And finally, firefighters in the Danish city of Horsens had to use a battering ram to gain access to a young man's house this week because he had gotten himself stuck in his own desk.
Initially, the firefighters tried to lift the tabletop to free the man. But when that was unsuccessful, they used cutting equipment to saw through the desk's metal supports.
You know, you'd expect him to be upset about his broken desk, but apparently he couldn't cheer less.
Callan, that was a desk-pickable pun.
I know, I'm sorry. That's all we have time for on this edition of World
what
in Focus.
What a shame.
Don't forget that you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh, and in just a moment we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And from me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye. Callan, you're stuck under the desk.